Okay, having asked you all to do some work in the last session, the next session is primarily informational, but I think it's an important update that we're going to receive on very important initiatives, because obviously part of the challenge of the ISB has been to convince countries to adopt IFRS, and clearly that revolves around establishing the credibility of IFRS as being high quality standards. To some extent, that's the easy part. The hard part, and often this council has focused on implementation issues, is to then actually implement that decision that a country has made effectively. And underpinning a lot of that is obviously a knowledge of IFRS and the training that is required to move people's knowledge from whatever form of gap they were adopting in their own country to the new international standards. And there's been a lot of effort, a lot of resources, and a lot of good thinking underpinning the ISB's initiatives in this area. And so for this session leading into lunch, we're going to have an update from Mike Wells on all the good work that is going on.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the warm introduction, and I hope we can have some fun in this session as well. We're going to ask you to do a few exercises to get a feel for the kind of work that we're doing, and it is supposed to be fun. If somebody is teaching IFRS and not enjoying it, or their students aren't enjoying it, I think they're doing it wrong. So hopefully we can have a bit of fun today as well. The last time I came to the council was in October 2011, when we had just set the next five-year plan. So today the purpose is really to give you an update on where we are with that plan and to give you a feel for some of the things that we are doing. So basically you all know the information supply chain and the different players in the information supply chain. And in our education initiative, we have projects which are focused on each of the components in that information supply chain to try and provide some support to them with a particular focus on developing people's ability to make the judgments and estimates that are necessary to apply IFRS. So the ability to apply IFRS, I think I can safely say without fear of contradiction, is not evenly spread around the world. So some parts of the world ask us to help them more than other parts, and we're willing to go where people ask us to go. But all of these functions can only be performed well, I believe, if we have good quality IFRS education. And that's not knowing what the requirements say. It's not knowing the mechanics of applying those requirements. The most important thing is being able to make the judgments and estimates that are necessary to apply those requirements. So all of our education focuses on the objective of financial reporting, because that is the focus of IFRS. So we never do a session of IFRS education without starting with the objective of IFRS financial reporting, or general purpose financial statements. So I just put the slide up. I know you all know it, so there's no need for me to go through it with you. But that is the focal point of everything that we do in our education initiative. So what are the main implementation challenges that we see when we go around the world helping people with IFRS education? One of the main difficulties that many people face is what I would call a mindset change. So some countries adopting IFRS have come from completely different accounting systems that require completely different skill sets. So getting a change in the mindset to focus on that resource allocation decision, focusing information on investors, lenders, and other creditors who can't demand that information from the entity is an important focus in what we do. And then trying to help build the skill set to make the judgments and estimates which are necessary to apply these standards. And as I've said, capacity to do so varies very much around the world. So there are a whole lot of implementation activities at the IFRS Foundation, at the ISB, as I'm sure you're all aware. Okay, I'm speaking just about our education initiative today. For those of you that are interested, there is a URL on this page which would link you to the five-year plan. It's a public document, so you can see exactly what our plans are to the end of 2016. So we are a fairly small team. As you know, the resources at the I4S Foundation are limited. So we have a team now of six people. That's a great increase. When we first started education, it was just me. So we now have a much bigger team than we had before. And the way that we achieve some degree of effect in the world is that we plan collectively. So when we set our next five-year plan, we will come to this committee, for example, and ask for your input on that. But we do have internal committees that focus on education, and there are external committees that advise us as well. So we set a fairly well-thought-through plan when we set our plan of activities for each five-year period. And the way that we develop and deliver on the plan is collectively with other people. So, for example, we might write some teaching material, but then we would get experts, for example, from some of the bigger accounting firms, some teachers, depending on who it's focused on this material, to review that material for us. And then much of our work is done with the world's development agencies and others, so the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and the other development agencies. So those development agencies often fund the translation of the material into widely spoken languages in the world. They set up train-the-trainer workshops or teach-the-teacher workshops, and we go help with the training in those environments. So we really look for a multiplier effect in everything that we do, and over the last couple of years, we've delivered about 50 events each year, which has kept us busy. So just by way of example of the multiplier effect, the first workshops that we ever ran in our education initiative were in January 2010 on the I4S for SMEs, when that was a new standard. The Asian Development Bank funded them, and we did a workshop in Kuala Lumpur and Hyderabad, and that's a series for them. In total, there were 85 trainers from 15 countries. And within 6 months of those workshops, those trainers had run another 50 workshops to train 4,500 people. And I saw that in CAPA's annual report is why it is the one that I've captured. So we've now done more than 30 workshops on the I4S for SMEs, and people from over 110 countries have attended those workshops. The main project that we're working on now, and this is a project that is very close to my heart because I used to teach I4S at a South African university. So our flagship project at the moment is trying to support people who are teaching I4S around the world to develop in their students the ability to make the judgments and estimates to apply these standards. And the way that we do that is we develop comprehensive teaching material. So we develop the teaching material at three stages. Stage one is the first financial reporting course that a student would be taking. Stage three is the last course immediately before they qualify as a CA or a CPA or the equivalent qualification in other environments. And stage two is halfway to qualification. And we develop comprehensive teaching material at each of those stages so that teachers can take that material and use it in their classes. So far we have published material on non-financial assets, and last month we published material on the IAS8 hierarchy, and we'll be looking at some examples from that material today. We're currently working on liabilities, business combinations, consolidations, and next we'll be going to impairment. Okay, so much of the translation work, as I've said, is done with development agencies and others, and much of the teaching workshops are done in conjunction with regional academic accounting associations. Last week I was with the American Accounting Association. In a few months' time we're with the European Accounting Association, and so on. Okay, the reason why we break this material down into three phases is we think looking at developing people's ability to make judgments, in the first stage, a first student's course, or a student's first course on I4S, just to create awareness of judgments at that stage. You couldn't expect a student who's just left school to be competent at making the judgments that they need to make to apply I4S after they've done their first course. So the first course is about creating awareness of the judgments. Halfway to qualification, it's about developing their understanding of those judgments. At the point of qualification, it's about being sure that they have the ability to make those judgments and estimates. So that's why we have a three-phased approach to this. Our framework-based teaching approach says basically, before you can attempt to account for anything, you need to understand the economics of what it is that you are trying to account for. So we encourage teachers, before they speak to their students about I4S requirements, to make sure that their students understand the economics and finance of the phenomenon that they're wanting them to account for. And then we ask them to ask the students, what information would you want if you were thinking of making an investment decision in that particular company? So look at a primary user of the financial statements and ask the students to come up with the information that they think they would want in order to base their investment or their lending decision. And only once they've done that would we then start looking at the I4S requirements. And if it's a question which is going to focus on whether assets and liabilities exist, we would say the first step in doing that is to look at the conceptual framework without looking at the standards and saying if we only had the definitions that we have in the conceptual framework of assets, liabilities, income, expense, and equity, what elements would exist? And only then look at the I4S requirements. And once you've looked at the I4S requirements, then say, is there a difference between what you expected I4S would deliver and what I4S is requiring be delivered? And discuss why there's a difference. So it's important for students to get a cohesive understanding of I4S. They need to understand why the IASB set a requirement that might appear not to maximize the objective of financial reporting. And that's often documented in the basis for conclusions to the standards, for example. And we encourage teachers to go through that with their students. Okay, and another sort of information that they could look at would be if there's a discussion paper or an exposure draft, what are the main principles in those discussion papers and exposure drafts, and how are they providing better information to the market. And then the focus is all on the judgments and estimates that need to be made in applying these standards. So I'm sure everybody in this room is familiar with the elements that we have in our conceptual framework, but I'm just putting them up there. In particular, we'll focus in the little exercise that we're going to do on the definition of an asset. So to be an asset, you need a resource controlled by the entity and from which we expect future economic benefits. Okay, so that's pretty much all we're looking for. So one doesn't need to be an accountant to do these exercises. One just needs to apply one's mind, I think. Okay, so one of the case studies that we developed is called the Open Safari case study, and we thought we wanted to come up with a case study if we were going to work with teachers on how to develop in their students the ability to make judgments and estimates. We wanted fact patterns that the teachers would not be familiar with, and that was the purpose of this case study. So it's a 20-page case study, and it does things like operates a photographic safari business in Africa. It covers commercial space travel, which is something that is about to begin this year, I believe, commercial space travel, and a couple of other activities that we thought teachers possibly were not teaching to their students and wouldn't be familiar with those fact patterns. To keep these fact patterns out of the environment where people can use memory recall, we only give the teaching notes that accompany these case studies to people that are teaching I4S. And in each PDF that we give out with the teaching notes in, we put a unique identifier so that if it ever turns up on the internet anywhere, we can trace to whom we gave those teaching notes. And the reason for that is these teaching notes working with the case studies will only be effective for as long as they're out of the public eye. Once a student can see the teaching notes, it's no longer about making judgments and estimates. It's about remembering what they read in the teaching notes. So that is why we keep the teaching notes only given out to people that are teaching IFRS. So just a few fun things that we did in the case study, for example. We started some sort of snorkeling safaris off some land that we had bought, and one of the questions that we asked the students, are those fish and whales and other things that are in the sea, are they an asset of the entity? Because we bought this land, and just off this land, okay, we take people into the sea to do these safaris. Okay, and I think most everybody in this room would fairly quickly come to the conclusion that we don't control the fish in the sea. Okay, so most people that we do this case study very quickly come to the conclusion that we don't control these fish in the sea. Then we buy another piece of land, which we call free lands, and this is unfenced land in Africa which adjoins a national park where all these wild animals are. We buy it so that we can operate photographic safaris from it. We legally own the animals whilst they are on our land, and this is law in South Africa, for example. If the wild animal walks off your land, though, it becomes the property of your neighbour. So now the question is, do we control these wild animals? The reason why we were prepared to pay a whole lot of money for this land is because these wild animals frequent that land. So we can, you know, run our safari business from that land. So now you have legal ownership, but do you have control? So to have control, you had to have a resource controlled by the entity. Clearly, we expected future economic benefits. So do we control these animals? Okay, so most people that we do this case study with come to the conclusion that we do not control these animals. So even though we legally own the animals, we don't control them. Okay, so that's the conclusion that most people come to. And then we say, but you also do bee farming. Okay, so you've got a hive, okay, with a whole lot of bees in it. And the bees, if you've got a fence or not, it doesn't make a huge difference to them. The bees do fly off your land because bees collect pollen and nectar or whatever they do from a massive area. Okay, but do we control the bees? Okay, so you can see what we're doing. We're trying to find examples where we can look at the judgments about control, and I don't think these are difficult judgments yet. We're doing easy judgments, okay, where people have to apply their minds and make a judgment. There's no rule telling you whether or not you control bees. You have to apply your mind. So to understand whether you control bees or not, you have to understand a bit about bee farming and, you know, the biology of bees, if you like. Okay, so the thing about bees is they have to come back to their hive. If they don't come back to their hive, they die. If they go to another hive, they get killed. Okay, so a bee is programmed to come back to its hive. So most people conclude we do control the bees. The way we control the bees is by providing the hive. Okay, you don't need to know anything about accounting to do that. Okay, it's about making a judgment. Okay, I think a fairly clear and easy judgment, but a judgment nevertheless. Then we do some more difficult things. We start looking at tourist carrying elephants. If you get the chance to do this, you should go do elephant back safari in Africa sometime. But we have an operation where we have elephants that we're taking people on unfenced land, okay, to go and do some photographic safari from the back of elephants. And the other animals think it's just an elephant, so they're not scared of the elephant, so you get nice and close. It's a nice thing to do. So do we control the elephant if the elephant's on unfenced land? Okay, so what's the judgment? How do we control the elephant? Well, you have a mahout that, you know, is assigned to each elephant and looks, so you get control of the elephant in some other way. Okay, so there's some interesting. That's a whole nother question. And then we'll look at asset classification in the next step, and this gets interesting, and we're sticking with the theme that we have. So let's take bees, for example, as something that's fairly straightforward. So I think most people in this room that know we have a standard IAS 41 on agriculture would look at the bees and say, clearly we're farming honey here from these bees. So clearly the bees would be in IAS 41. Now the wax sheets are interesting because you put wax sheets inside the hive so that the bees can build their honey on that wax sheet. Okay, so now we say to students, how would you classify the wax sheet? Okay, so that should be easy. I mean, most of us would think, well, we know how to classify the wax sheet. But there's a small trick in this one because there are two ways the wax sheet can be used. Okay, the wax sheet could be used over and over again in that you take the frame out of the hive, you extract the honey from it, and you put the wax sheet in the frame back in the hive. Or if, for posh people who like to eat wax, you can take the comb out of the frame and sell the honey on the comb. Why people like eating wax, I have no idea. But there are people that do this. It's a lot more expensive, okay, because it takes more effort, obviously, to make this. So it matters the purpose to which that wax sheet is put once it is put in the hive. So if it's reused in the hive over and over again, clearly it would be property, plant, and equipment, whilst if the honey is sold on the comb, most people would conclude that it's inventory. So it's just some interesting things like that. Then tourist carrying elephants. Now we're getting to more difficult judgments. Okay, so here you're looking at the line between property, plant, and equipment and biological assets and agricultural activity. Okay, so we don't have a standard, and I hope we never have a standard, for tourist carrying elephants. Okay, so but we do have a standard for property, plant, and equipment, and we do have one for biological assets and agricultural activity. Okay, but you sometimes end up with things that kind of aren't clearly in one or the other. Okay, so they're somewhere in between. And that's where it starts getting difficult. So a simple example other than this one to illustrate it, if you have a bird breeding zoo, okay, if you have a bird breeding operation, you just breed birds, it's clearly biological assets and agricultural activity. But if you have a zoo, and let's say you only have male birds in the zoo, and people come to observe those birds, it's clearly not biological assets and agricultural activity. So it would be IAS 16, you're providing a service with those assets. The problem is when you have a bird breeding zoo, now you've got two cash flow streams, no standard for bird breeding zoos, so you have to make a judgment. Okay, so teaching our students how to make those judgments is what we're trying to do here. Okay, and that's what this is about. So tourist carrying elephants have some of those judgments in them. Okay, we could be harvesting something from these elephants. The safari I went on wasn't a great breeding operation. There were five elephants, four males and one female. The female did have a calf, though, and she was pregnant again. So there was some breeding operation going on as well. So there were some suggestions of perhaps some agriculture-type activities. If the trade in ivory was legalized again, okay, maybe we'd be harvesting ivory from these animals as well, which has a high value. So you can see how by fiddling with the fact patterns, and we encourage students, teachers to do that, to fiddle with the fact patterns to get, you know, different outcomes. Okay, and the last one is quaggas, and we put that there because only South Africans can pronounce quaggas. So it's, but these animals were supposed to have gone extinct, but in our case study, we found the last few quaggas on this piece of land that we owned. Okay, it was fenced land, so most people would conclude we control the quaggas. So the question about the quaggas is, are they biological assets in agricultural activity, or are they property, plant, and equipment? Okay, and there was one of the big accounting firms in South Africa had to give an opinion on a case that is not too dissimilar from this. So a piece of fenced land that is big enough was bought with a whole range of wild animals on it. Okay, and we weren't doing much for those animals except there was a fence. So it was a photographic safari business that was fenced off. They'd concluded they controlled the animals but had to classify them. For them to be biological assets in agricultural activity, we would have to be actively managing the biological transformation of those animals. So the question with the quaggas is the same. Are we actively managing their biological transformation? And you have to make judgments about whether you are or whether you are not. In the case in South Africa that the big accounting firm gave the opinion on, they said they were not biological assets in agricultural activity because constructing the fence on its own wasn't enough to say you were actively managing the biological transformation of those assets. But this is interesting, isn't it? Okay, and that's how it should be. I think all of this is interesting. So the purpose of the last page of the Open Safari case study was to look at the judgments around depreciation, because I see lots of questions coming to our interpretations committee about how to do depreciation. And personally, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around what depreciation is doing in IFRS. So to illustrate the judgments in depreciation well, you need a very unusual fact pattern. So I thought, well, commercial space travel is something that's starting up. People would probably be interesting to students to think about commercial space travel. But more importantly for me, there's an opportunity to look at a strange fact pattern. The first few people that fly on those commercial spacecrafts are going to pay a fortune. So the fact pattern that we're providing, we're saying we'll only make 5 flights in the first year, but revenue will be massive in the first year. In the fourth year, we're going to make 50 flights, but revenue, total revenue, will be relatively low in the fourth year. So total revenue is collapsing each year. The number of flights that we are doing is jumping up each year. Okay, we said there's a space authority, and they say the most flights the spacecraft can do is 100 flights, then it has to be taken out of service. We think economically the spacecraft can do 150 flights. The space authorities tell us they have to be done in 5 years. The space authorities have to inspect our spacecraft every 2 years, irrespective of whether we fly it or not. So how many flights it has is irrelevant to the inspection. The inspection cost is significant. It's something like $20 million. Okay, we intend to destroy the spacecraft after it has made after it reaches the end of its useful life. And the reason we're going to destroy it is not because it's worthless. It's actually worth a lot of money. But we want to destroy it so that other people don't get the technology that's embedded in that spacecraft. And some people, when I've been doing this case study, have said that's not dissimilar to what happens in the arms industry. So it's not made up. Okay, so here we're thinking about residual value. So is the residual value of the spacecraft zero because we're going to destroy the spacecraft at the end of its useful life? Or is the residual value of the spacecraft at the end of its useful life what we could have sold the spacecraft for had we not destroyed it? Okay, and before we can look at depreciation, we have to think about what is depreciation in IFRS? And that's quite different from what depreciation is in most other GAAPs that I've had a look at. Depreciation in IFRS is reflecting how we consume the service potential of that asset. So we have to work out how do we consume the service potential of this asset before we can think about depreciating it. And that's a judgment. And this spacecraft had components. We know it's got an inspection component. We also said that there was another component where we would replace the fittings after 50 flights because, you know, these people paying a lot of money want a clean seat. Okay, but the judgment we were looking for there was about materiality because this, relative to the cost of the spacecraft, is nothing. Okay, so the judgment there was identify that this is immaterial and therefore we only have two components. We've got the inspection component and we've got the rest of the spacecraft. Now, the inspection component, the inspection had to be done every 2 years irrespective of how many flights were made. So how are we consuming the service potential of the inspection component? What depreciation method would reflect how we consume that component? A time basis. We consume it over time. The inspection's done today, irrespective of how many flights we do, the inspection's done again in 2 years' time. So most people that look at this case study come to the conclusion, and that's how we write the teaching notes. We conclude what other people tell us because we're not interpreting. Okay, so most people we've done this case study with conclude that that component is consumed on the basis of time. Seems reasonable to me. What about the rest of the spacecraft, the other component of the spacecraft? How are we consuming its service potential? Is it time? Is it flights? Okay, so the limiting factor with the spacecraft is it can fly into space economically 150 times, but there's a legal restriction it can fly only 100 times. We expect to make those 100 flights within 4 years. The time we have legally to make those flights is 5 years. So most people who look at this conclude that the way we consume the service potential of the body and all the other components except the inspection component, okay, is on the basis of 100 flights. So what does this mean? When we depreciate the spacecraft in the first year, we make 5 out of 100 flights, 5% of the spacecraft would be depreciated in the first year. Half the spacecraft would be depreciated in the fourth year. How much revenue do we have in the first year? A massive amount of revenue, a little bit of revenue, or relatively small amount of revenue in the fourth year. But depreciation is reflecting how we consume the service potential of the asset. So economically, what is happening, and I think it reflects the economics well, in the first year we make a big margin, don't we? People pay more because they're showing off to their friends. That we make a lower margin on the ones in the fourth year. And now you have to think about what is the residual value of that spacecraft. And that's perhaps the most difficult judgment here. Okay, so that gives you a feel for some of the things that we're doing. This material has been translated into all the world's widely spoken languages. So if you look at the green shaded areas on this map, this material is translated into the languages that are spoken in those countries. So it's available to most everybody in the world. The places where you can see the little circles, that's where we have run Train the Trainer workshops, and the number of days is indicated inside the circle. You've got a lot of good external feedback on these case studies and the approach that we're taking, so we're very pleased about that. We also do workshops for regulators, particularly in the developing world, where the development agencies ask us to help them with this, where they have accounting reform programs. We use the same case studies. It's the same skill, whether you're an auditor, a regulator, a preparer. It's the same skill that you need, essentially. So we've run a couple of those around the world, and again, the feedback from the regulators has been very positive. We have a project, I would say a smaller part of our work is focused particularly on preparers and auditors, and these are mainly some of the big conferences that our education initiative arranges, which I know many of you have attended in the past, and this slide sets out where those will be held in the coming year. Around those conferences, we do implementation sessions on the new IFRSs that have been issued but have not yet reached their effective dates. And in those sessions, we're trying to get people who have early adopted or advising others on how to implement these new standards to share their experience with other people who are yet to implement those new requirements so that those people can benefit from the good work and experience of the people who are advising and who have already implemented those standards. So this slide just shows where we've held those conferences and workshops over the past few years. The red shaded ones are big accounting firm conferences that we co-brand. The green ones are the ones that we have done on our own. I spoke briefly about the IFRS for SMEs Train the Trainer workshops. This doesn't present very well on the slide, but it is a map of the world. And it shows where we've held these workshops and with whom we have held these Train the Trainer workshops on the IFRS for SMEs. A new project that we have is to focus on investors. So we now have an investor education project. It's a new project. We're finding our way in what we will be doing in this project. But one of the outputs that we have recently is with the CFA Institute, and we've got Vincent, I see, at the top of the page. At the top of the table. In these multimedia presentations, Vincent is interviewing Patrick Finnegan, our board member, and Fred Nieto, our investor project manager, on a number of issues, and building for the investor community material to help them, particularly on new IFRSs that are coming out. So that's an exciting new project that we added since I spoke to you last, actually. So this was in 2012. We added the regulator workshops and we added the investor focus project. So for those of you that were here when we presented the original plan did not include those activities. These are things that we have added since then. Okay, the last thing, I think I have about 2 minutes. So The case study that we published just the other day was the amalgam case study. The purpose of this case study is to help people make the judgments that are necessary to apply the IS8 hierarchy. So these are real judgments that one has to make. You know, everybody's students, when they get out there, there are things that IFRS does not tell you how to account for, and you need the IS8 hierarchy to write your accounting policy on how to account for those. So this came about, it wasn't in our original plan to do this case study, but people asked us that this is an area of judgment where they would like some teaching material, so we added this case study. So it deals with four things: mushroom farming, it deals with gold held as a store of wealth, artworks held as a store of wealth, and business combinations under common control. So those are the areas where there isn't specific guidance in IFRS. And mushroom farming, you must be thinking, but we've got IAS 41 agriculture, don't we? So why wouldn't mushroom farming be in IAS 41 agriculture? Okay, and I think that's all I've got time left is to discuss that with you. So in the case study, we say when the person goes out, you know, we've just bought this mushroom farm, when our group financial accountant goes out to this mushroom farm, he is surprised to learn that mushrooms are neither living plants nor living animals. And if you look at IAS 41, the definition of biological assets is living plants and living animals. Okay, so it's a very easy example, I think, because in the IS8 hierarchy, when you come to apply your IS8 hierarchy, and I'll just skip through to that slide, the first step in the hierarchy is if you can find something that deals with a similar and related issue. Okay, and this is the one where I think no one has suggested this is not a similar and related issue. So I wanted something nice and easy to start with. Okay, so you know, I have yet to come across somebody who says mushroom farming is not similar and related to the farming of other, well, of what we define as biological. And this is the problem when we write standards and you get someone from New York to write a standard on agriculture. And that is a joke, in case anyone was wondering. But this is the kind of thing that can crop up when you write a standard. Is there a problem? No, there's no problem. Anyone who's mushroom farming would go to the IS8 hierarchy and analogize to farming, wouldn't they? Okay, to farming other biological assets in agricultural activity. So I don't think there's a problem, okay, but it just illustrates how the words that we write matter sometimes, or not. Okay, so that's basically what the case study was about. I've done the easy one, which we solved in the first step in the IS8 hierarchy. Some of the others you might be going down to the second step. Some of them, the feedback that we got when the case study was, when we ran the case study and developing the teaching notes with people around the world, was not unanimous. So we reflect that in the teaching notes in the case study. We reflect as faithfully as we can the responses that we get from people when we run these case studies with them. Okay, so it's been a lot of fun for us. It's been a really rewarding project. People seem to be liking it around the world, and we hope that it will make a difference in the longer term to how IFRS is applied, because that is our goal, to try and help people develop in their students the ability to make the judgments and estimates that are necessary to apply these standards. So I thank you very much for your attention.
And who thought accounting was boring? Thank you, Mike, for updating us on this very important initiative. We are out of time, given that we're now due to have lunch, and then we've got a couple of sessions after lunch. Anyone that wants to catch up with Mike or get some more information or make an observation is very available. And no doubt, as you develop sort of the next five-year plan, you will come back and report to the council. So again, thank you for the informative update, and particularly for the manner in which you presented it. It's sort of a nice lead-in to lunch. So thank you again.